The Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast is proud to be sponsored by Dr. Spork's 3D Terrain. From retro greenskin outposts to elven fortresses and obelisks, this is hands down the best nostalgic scenery you'll find out there, and all at stupidly reasonable prices. Check it out for yourself by heading over to bedroombattlefields.com/spork, that's S-P-O-R-K, and turn your tabletop into a scene from White Dwarf circa 1994. Andy Chambers not included. Brought to you by bedroombattlefields.com, this is the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. If you're a fan of the Oldhammer aesthetic or folklore-inspired creatures and worlds, then you probably love Oakbound Studio. And if you don't already, then you most definitely will by the end of this chat with founder and sculptor Jeff Solomon Sims. As is often the way in these chats, I kick things off by asking him about his hobby origin story.
Well, yeah, I mean, so much of the modern day harks right back to there. So I think that's a good place to start. I think like an awful lot of people, my first miniatures were HeroQuest, the boxed HeroQuest game back in, I think I got mine as part of the relaunch in 91 rather than the 89. I've been trying to track down how old I was, and I was born in 84. So I think 5 years might be a little bit young for the first release of the HeroQuest set, but I think 91, I was seven. So that seems more likely. So I remember very vividly that was Christmas 1991, or just after, because my cousin had brought his HeroQuest set to my grandparents' house where we were all spending Christmas together. And so I spent all Christmas playing that with him and my parents. I remember it being Boxing Day, so it may have been Boxing Day, or that may just be a false memory, but I remember them bringing a belated Christmas present, which was my own HeroQuest box. Obviously, they thought it was worth rushing out to buy something that was going to shut me up for a few weeks while I got busy on that. So that was where I started. And then I lived in a little village in the middle of Dorset. So there weren't big game stores anywhere near me, but the toy shop in the neighboring village had a very small selection of Games Workshop blisters. Probably no more than 20 odd different blisters to choose from in the shop. So I would go there with my pocket money once a month and find whatever the blister was that really appealed to me. I wasn't collecting an army. I wasn't really interested in putting together big forces. I was buying the odd figure to stick into my HeroQuest set based on what I liked the look of in the blister pack. And I was always far more interested in converting and painting stuff than in actually playing the games a lot of the times. I had a few friends in the village who played, and we got because back then was the fourth edition box was out with the plastic high elves and goblins, and the toy shop had a number of the kind of quick start guides that were in that boxed set, where it was one goblin archer versus an elf spearman, I think. So you learn how shooting worked and how close combat worked from a one-on-one basis. And we basically just played Warhammer using those rules. So whatever figures we all had, they were either goblins or they were elves profile-wise. And we just used those and pushed a dozen or so figures around the table for quite a long time. It was only really when the fifth edition box came out that we started actually learning what the rules were and playing the game properly, as it were, with larger forces. But even then, I had a few trips to a bigger Games Workshop in a city nearby, and they had the catalogs that you could get mail order from that had all of the older ranges in. You could order any figures from their back catalog. And I remember pouring through this catalog and thinking, these figures are way cooler than what's out at the moment. You know, why have they gone backwards? Why is there cartoony orcs on the shelves and not these kind of gribbly things from the mid 80s? So even though I never played third edition when it first came out, second edition when it first came out, wasn't collecting the figures when they were actually on the shelves, the older kind of aesthetic of those things always had a bit more of an appeal to me than the kind of middle hammer sets of the mid 90s. And then, of course, I got into other things. So I was doing a lot of work with some local theatres, got into set design and prop making, and went to university to study stage management, but really kind of concentrating on prop making and set building, set construction, and went into work into that field for a good few years and kind of forgot about miniatures. I was still a big fan of folklore things and still a big fan of history and fantasy, and I'd go to reenactment fairs and that kind of thing, but I wasn't doing an awful lot of gaming or buying figures or collecting. But what I was doing in terms of sort of sculpting fantasy stuff was big scale stuff. I was doing, you know, masks and set pieces and props for theatres and TV companies and things. So doing sort of true scale sculpture bits and pieces. And then I moved to Bristol in 2010, somewhere around there, and became good friends with a couple of guys that lived near me, and they were into miniature gaming, and I sort of remembered that it existed. By that point, I'd got rid of all of my figures bar a handful, so everything was gone, starting from scratch again. But we picked up between us the eighth edition Warhammer Fantasy box set, the Isle of Blood, and split the figures and started playing again. And at that point, eBay, I guess, was fairly young. It had been around for 5 or 6 years, and you could still, because there wasn't much market for the old metal figures in those days, you could still pick them up reasonably inexpensively. So I started building my collection again with the models that I'd seen largely in those older catalogues. So going back to the 80s figures that I would have definitely got my hands on had they been in Games Workshop at the time. And so my collection is now far bigger than it was back when I was a kid, but I've been able to pick up quite a lot of the things that I would have wanted to back then. And then the old hammer scene started getting going, I'd say around 2010, 2012. So I met some good people online. The Bring Out Your Lead, the annual Old Hammer gathering, started going. So I started going up to that and playing more of the older rule sets. So that's kind of my history in the hobby. It's really been pretty much exclusively Warhammer as a fantasy war game, and other Games Workshop games. I had Space Hulk and Space Crusade and HeroQuest and Advanced HeroQuest, but I kind of dipped my toe into military modeling a little bit while I was at school. I had some Historics 54mm and was painting those. I had a couple of books by a phenomenal painter by the name of Bill Horan, who is an American, I believe, Napoleonic large-scale painter. And so I learned a lot of painting technique and sculpting from his books, because it was a very different style to the style that was around in White Dwarf at the time. But I never really took to the historicals scene. The fantasy stuff was always really where I wanted to be, and not even the 40k, the kind of sci-fi-ish stuff that held a bit of an appeal for a while, because I had some friends when third edition 40k came out who were playing that, and I didn't really know anyone who was playing fantasy at the time, so I played some of that. But really the fantasy side of things is what grabs my attention rather than any of the other genres.
Yeah, it's definitely there's a lot of parallels there with my own kind of story and being pretty much the same age and having HeroQuest as that first kind of touch point. And I agree, like with myself, my first kind of look at a Citadel miniature was the combat cards. So those miniatures were very much the old 80s miniatures. But then the first stuff I got, which I still like, was the Battlemasters plastics and the fourth edition plastics and so on. Again, I do like them as well, but there was something about that 80s look that it was just a bit more unique and everything was individual, and it just, I could see why that really jives with a lot of folk.
Yeah, absolutely. It was less, I don't want to say that things became formulaic, because that's perhaps a little bit incorrect, but there definitely became a particular aesthetic that they were going for. Whereas back in the earlier days, I guess, you've got such a wide array of artists, and they're employing people who are sculptors, but who are coming from very different backgrounds. So they've each got their own style. So the ranges have a lot more diversity to them than they do by the time you've reached the kind of mid-90s, and the lore has been codified a bit more. The influences on the ranges have been a bit more sort of set in stone. So everything starts to look more homogenous, I guess, and not quite so crazy and weird. It's good that you mentioned the combat cards, because actually that's probably true. I probably did have a set of those combat cards, maybe even before I got my HeroQuest set, certainly around the same time. I think I remember them being a gift from my great aunt, but I would spend ages on holiday looking at I had the Goblinoids deck. That was the first one I got. And I spent ages on holiday looking at those images, trying to work out if they were actual miniatures that had been painted, or if they were paintings on the cards themselves. You know, if it was 2D artwork, and my young brain couldn't quite get its head around what I was looking at. And one of my favorite projects when I got back into the gaming scene was being able to pick up all of the orcs in that combat cards deck and paint those kind of in the style, try and do an homage to each figure in that deck. So I've now got framed on the wall of my studio a complete set of the combat cards miniatures painted in kind of as best I can do the equivalent tones. It took a long time. I think it took me about 3 years to collect all of the figures. And most of that is because there are two or three models in there that are, I say conversions, but they're actually pretty much scratch builds. And so it took me a long time to get my sculpting confidence up to the point where I could even attempt those models. And then it took me another 3 years to get around to actually starting painting on them, because I was nervous that my painting skills weren't up to doing justice to the cards. And they probably still aren't, to be fair. Fraser Gray's really crisp enamel blending on those models is just absolutely phenomenal. But yeah, I'm happy to have a kind of stand-in collection in my studio.
Do you have 10 seconds, literally 10 seconds, to tell me how and where you typically listen to the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast? If so, find our micro survey over at bedroombattlefields.com/fast, tick a couple of boxes, and you'll have helped your old pal out here immensely. That's bedroombattlefields.com/fast, F-A-S-T, and now back to the show. It was such a sort of, when you think back to that era, it was such a breadcrumb trail for us all, because, you know, I remember like getting the combat cards on holiday in Cornwall. This would have been like 92, maybe 91. And you're just, like you say, you don't really, it's not like you pull out your phone and, you know, what are these? All you had was the cards, and you didn't really know where did they come from, what are they? And then you've got the HeroQuest advert on the TV, and then in the Argos catalogue, you know, you've got Battlemasters and stuff. So it's all these wee things, and you don't really know if they're all connected, but, you know, you keep seeing these wee things. And eventually, of course, I think we all at some point got our hands on one of these wee leaflets that was in one of the boxes. You know, do you want more stuff? And then the rest is history, I suppose.
It's a really tantalizing thing. I guess that's part of why I really like tracking down the kind of mysteries behind some of these figures. So the interviews that Film Deck Miniatures have been doing with various people in the Games Workshop staff through the years, and the books like Talking Miniatures and Dice Men, they all kind of illuminate a little bit of this past. And so it's as you say, it's the age before the internet, so you couldn't just go and look stuff up, and people's memories are not all quite the same, and there'll be that kind of tantalizing picture that you've got to work out what that figure in the background is, and who painted it, and what range did it come from. And there's, go digging through catalogs to try and find it. It's the kind of almost that mystery appeal, that sense of you're getting a very partial view of something and you want to know more about it, that makes it a very intriguing thing to look into. That was an appeal at the time as well. There's figures that I remember turning up in White Dwarf that I couldn't put my finger on because they were from much earlier ranges. They were just kind of hiding in the background of photographs, and you look and go, what's that Necromancer? That's a weird, I like that model, but I'm not going to find it in a Games Workshop store, and it's not in the catalog. What is it? And then with the rise of the internet and the Lost Minis wiki and things, and you can start to kind of piece together where you've seen stuff. And yeah, it's a real kind of voyage of discovery, finding out all these little things that are really completely inconsequential, but they're very engrossing, and you can really lose yourself in a project trying to pin down that exact thing and who painted it and where is it now. It's one of the wondrous things going up to War Games Foundry in Newark and looking in the cabinets there, that they've got so many of these old figures from the pages of White Dwarf, and they're in brilliant condition. They're really, really well preserved and really well looked after, and the paint jobs on them are insane. If you look at these things in person, the colors are just they're so radiant. And I was listening to an interview with Mike McVeigh talking about the kind of heavy metal painting style of the 90s and how they realized that you had to really accentuate the contrast on things, and you had to go really much, much brighter than you would if you were just painting for yourself for the tabletop, because the photography wasn't up to picking up that kind of nuance in color. So you lost an awful lot of the detail and the color that was on those miniatures just by the fact that they were photographed and then put in magazine print. If you see those figures in real life, however good you think they are painted from looking in the magazine, they are worlds above that. It's mad.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. In that cabinet, I've been lucky enough to spend a bit of time in front of myself, and you always spot something new, don't you? And there's been a few times as well, like I'll be reading through an old rule book, or I just recently got the 40k second edition book, which I've been reading through, and I was looking at a couple of the photos and I was like, I've seen that in the cabinet, it's there. So yeah. I'm so glad that it's the Ansels that have that stuff as well. Like, that's such a fitting custodianship of it, I guess,
yeah.
Isn't it?
So. Yeah, definitely. And clearly are still very attached to it. It means an awful lot to them as a collection. And there are a few things that are in Warhammer World, or at least they were the last time I was there. So I don't know if you remember, you talked about the little folded up leaflets that were in the Battle Masters and HeroQuest boxes. I remember there was a Space Marine librarian and an apothecary with a banner, and I think it was a chaplain as well, which were those were the first Space Marines that I'd seen other than the Space Crusade figures. And so they are something that really sticks in my head as being like the iconic space warriors of that era. And those, last time I was in Warhammer World, those were in Warhammer World. So there are sort of split around places, but you're right, a lot of that stuff is in the cabinets of Foundry. And every time I go up, I'm working on some slightly different project, I clock different figures in the cabinet there. And I don't know that they have that greater turnover. I think it's probably the same figures in each time. It's just that I'm looking for slightly different things, and so I notice that they're in there. But yeah, it's a wonderful collection.
So you gave us a really good background about, your hobby going through childhood and into coming back into it, and the kind of origins of Oldhammer. But how do you then transition into actually creating stuff?
Well, that was kind of something that just happened. So I think I mentioned when I got into the Oldhammer scene, I wanted to create a Fenrir army, and that ties in with HeroQuest, obviously, because they were the big green skin monster in the HeroQuest set, but also with this kind of sense of mystery, that there were a race that they devised in order to attempt to do their own Warhammer World specific creature. Kind of at the time, RuneQuest had the Brew, which the kind of beast men as they became in Warhammer, and Brian Ansell decided that the Warhammer World needed its own creature as well. So I forget who it was, and that's really terrible because that is such a that they as a race are such a key thing to my coming back into the scene. But I think it might have been Graham Davis was tasked with creating the lore for these creatures. And he basically took, I've got it behind me on the shelf here. There was a book of Irish folk tales, which were written by Michael Scott. And the cover was illustrated by Alan Lee, who was one of my favorite artists because of his work with Lord of the Rings, and more specifically for me, his work with Brian Froud on the Fairies book, that was one of the books that I came to again and again and again as a child. It was one of my favorites. And on the back of this cover, Alan Lee's painted a Fomorian from the Irish myths, and they feature in the first chapter of this book. But he's painted this creature, and it's kind of got a long green snout and a single eye, and it's carrying an axe. And if you've seen the Jez Goodwin limited edition Vermeer, the 28mm one, not the Nick Bibby 54 or bigger creature models, that is very much taken one for one from that illustration by Alan Lee. And so you've kind of got this merging of, it's a HeroQuest monster, it's a monster that's influenced by an Alan Lee painting, who's one of my favorite artists, and it's rooted in the Fomorians of Irish folklore, and Irish folklore is something that I'm big keen on. So just the whole thing's kind of came together, and like, this is the type of creature that I want to have as my army. But they completely failed. They completely flopped as a commercial entity. It's been attributed largely to some slightly dubious law that was written regarding the reproductive habits of the creature, which we don't need to go into. A lot has been said about that. I'm not sure that the failure of them as a species was entirely due to that. I think there were probably the specificity of the design of them made them not very popular. The fact that, or at least the myth goes, that Nick Bibby and whoever was writing the rules for them kind of got the wrong end of the stick, and the rules were written for 28mm scale figures, but Nick produced them as ogre-sized figures, so there was a bit of a mismatch there. Actually, I don't think that's necessarily true, because the stat lines are actually quite good. I think they work quite well for an ogre-sized creature, but I can see that if you are wanting a unit of 10 of them and they're all ogre-sized, and then you're going to try and do an army full of ogre-sized units, is going to get very expensive very quickly, and they're a pain to rank up because they've got those separate great big tails that stick out beyond the bases, so they're very awkward figures to rank up. So yeah, they were not popular, so there were not many of them produced. So when I decided that I wanted to do an army of them, the first thing that I started doing was collecting the old plastic lizard men from the 5th edition box set. I think I had some kicking around anyway, and then resculpting them, carving the scales off, sculpting new heads for them to make Fim Warriors out of those. And out of that, I started sculpting full figures. And I posted some pictures up on the Old Hammer forum, and a couple of people said, are you going to get those cast up? I'd quite like some. So I decided to look into it, and found, I was living in Bristol, and there was a company in Birmingham called Griffin Molds, who did molding and casting metal figures, and it wasn't that expensive to get a mold made. So I ran some stuff up to them, and they put it in a mold and span some metal casts for me, and I gave them at kind of cost price or slightly above cost price to people on the forum, and there seemed to be some demand for it. So I just started doing a few things. I thought, just, you know, for fun, I can sculpt the figures that I want in my collection, and then I can get them cast up, and a few people will buy them, and that will pay for the molds, and I'll have metal miniatures that I want in my collection, and I'll have enjoyed sculpting them and having the challenge of making something that's moldable, castable. And things really kind of snowballed a bit from there. I had started working on a rule set that was one of my favorite rule sets when I was younger was the Necromunda, but I never actually had the Necromunda set because it was too expensive. I had the Trinity Battleground set, which I don't know if you remember. That was a white wolf one of White Wolf's only forays into miniature production, with miniatures by Bob Naismith, and that had kind of, it's a good game, and I've recently reacquired, I say recently, like 5 years ago, reacquired another copy of it to actually play. But so I loved Necromunda, and I got back into Necromunda when I got back into gaming in the 2010s. And it kind of bugged me a little bit that although Necromunda plays out in a very rich environment, you've got lots of terrain and opportunities for moving up and down buildings and interacting with stuff, it's a very combat-focused game. There's a lot of shooting and hand-to-hand combat and not much else. Occasionally, you're asked to pick stuff up as part of an objective, but that's really as far as it goes. So I was writing a rule set that would enable you to play similar games, but have a lot more interaction with the environment and with other models on a non-combat basis. And at the same time, I had just done a little Kickstarter for a bunch of Celtic folklore miniatures. And so I was going around a few game shows with those. And people were asking me, oh, what rule set are these for? I don't know. I don't have a rule set. I just sculpted some figures that I quite liked. So just buy them and use them for whatever you're using them for. And I got talking with a guy who was producing a Celtic folklore role-playing game. And he'd written the rules for it, but he was a bit stuck on kind of some background for it. So I ended up doing a bunch of writing Celtic folklore background or Celtic folklore-influenced background. And that project really kind of fell apart. Nothing came of it, but I then had this set of background that I was quite happy with and a set of rules for a more sci-fi based game that I was quite happy with. And so myself and a couple of friends started putting the two together and modifying it and changing it into this kind of Celtic folklore miniatures game. And that's where the woods came from initially. It was a kind of marrying of a figure range that I wanted to make and a world that I was creating for somebody else. And yeah, and then they came together, and that was 2016, the first rule book came out. So 10 years ago, 2019, after a lot of playing of the first one, I came out with a revised edition, and then a lot more playing since. We've got the new edition, which is the Shiver Shield, the wood skirmish game, is coming out next weekend at Salute. So it's been a bit of a journey for the last 10 years from just throwing stuff together, but it's still a hobby for me. It's not by any chance my main job, and I'm still just making the figures that interest me, writing background that's based on stuff that interests me. So yeah, it is very much a personal project, and if other people like it and get excited about it, then that's great. I'm very happy to share their excitement. It's not like I've sort of set out to think what's going to sell. I'm still just doing the stuff that interests me, and if it sells in enough quantity for me to do the next thing bigger and better and brighter, then great. That's all I'm looking for, really.
Yeah, it sounds like you're in a really good place. Well, and it's fascinating to hear kind of how it all came about, how things aligned for it. And, you know, if we think about the sculpting for a second, well, firstly, like, I'm assuming, you know, by talking to you and also looking at the miniatures that you make, that you've got that heavy inspiration from the old Hammer era. And then also, you know, it doesn't seem like the sort of thing that just anyone could turn their hand to. So was there maybe parts of your design job that helped you pick up those skills quicker, or you know, what do you think on that front?
Yeah, very, very definitely. I mean, it's a world away from sculpting a creature at 1-to-1 size and sculpting it at 28mm. I remember going into a games workshop back in the late 90s and mentioning to one of the guys behind the till how incredible it was that anyone could sculpt anything that small. And I remember very clearly his response was, well, they can't. Nobody sculpts anything that size. Everyone sculpts everything at 3 times the size and they shrink it down. I was like, oh, okay. Oh, well, that's interesting. And if he hadn't said that, because that wasn't true, what he was thinking about was the plastics, which at that time were sculpted three ups. And then a pantograph was used to reduce the size to make the injection molds that the plastics were injected into. But all of the metal figures were sculpted the right size. They were sculpted. There's a little bit of shrinkage in the molds, but certainly not three times. And if he hadn't said that, if he'd been slightly better informed about the company that he was working for, I could have started sculpting a lot earlier and I'd probably be a lot better now. There are definitely some techniques that marry over and some that don't. So when I'm sculpting at full size, I'll usually be working in Chavant or Monster Clay or something like that, which is a wax-based modeling clay. So it doesn't set, but it hardens as it cools down. So you have to warm it up either with by rubbing it in your hands or with a heat gun or something just to get it at a workable temperature to work with. And there are lots of things that you can do texturally with that, smoothing it and things that you can't do. The medium doesn't work in a smaller scale. But the 28 millimeter stuff is a lot easier to handle and store and move around, obviously. So I'd say it helps. So I think what really helps in terms of a design aesthetic is just having spent such a long time with the Brian Froud books and with The Labyrinth and Dark Crystal as films. So my dream when I was a kid was to work for Henson's Creature Shop. That was what I really wanted to do. So all of that puppetry, all of that creature making, I really studied in massive detail. And although the processes are very different from creating a gaming miniature to creating a full-size puppet or animatronic, aesthetically, there's no reason that you can't carry that aesthetic on. And I don't see an awful lot of sculptors working with that kind of look. There's a bit in the Trudvang miniatures have a bit of that look because they're based on Paul Bonner artwork. And Paul Bonner has similar sort of Scandinavian troll influences to Brian Froud. The work of Frank Bauer is an influence on him as it was on Brian. So there's this kind of rich culture of troll art that's kind of getting a little bit out there, but it's still quite outside of the mainstream look of fantasy miniatures. A lot of fantasy miniatures are quite generic, I guess. You could mix and match different manufacturers very easily, whereas doing something that takes a very different point of origin gives you a very distinctive look. You then, if I was working on a commercial background, a commercial basis, it would be a really stupid decision because you then can't use those figures very easily in other rule sets or alongside other ranges. So you're kind of doing yourselves out of customers then. But as it's still a hobby project for me, as it's still, you know, just sculpting the things that I want to see out there, and as long as it covers its costs, that's great. And I'm delighted to see that there are actually plenty of people out there who are also like that aesthetic, but it's not very compatible, cross-compatible with other things that are out there. But it also really lends itself to the handmade side of things. I know the Trudvang miniatures are digitally sculpted and they've done a good job of that. But the kind of slightly raw edge that you get from sculpting, I'm quite big on lack of perfection. Maybe that's not something that as a sculptor you should strive for. I think a lot of people strive for things to be absolutely perfect and spot on, but things in real life aren't absolutely perfect or spot on. And you sometimes, some of those kind of quirks of character that you read into a figure are just, they're just inaccuracies and imperfections, really. If you've got a completely symmetrical, polished object, then it sits in that uncanny valley where something reads it as it's not quite natural. It's too symmetrical, it's too smooth, it's too perfect. Whereas if you're working by hand, nothing is ever going to be completely symmetrical. No matter how good you are, it's not going to be completely symmetrical. You're always going to get rough surfaces. You're going to get the odd fingerprint that you haven't buffed out in time. And all of these little things just add a little bit more texture, a little bit more character to the sculpt as it comes out. And so even on a subconscious level, I think there is something that when the human eye looks at something that is immaculately proportioned and perfectly smooth and designed with optimal symmetry, and it's really naturalistic. There's still something that the brain goes, there's something not quite right there, and it kind of repels a little bit. Whereas if you've got a bit more of a kind of natural organic look to something, then the brain doesn't rebel in quite that way against it. I don't know, that's probably nonsense, that's probably just me justifying my love of older figures, but so many people say that these old figures have soul, which new digital sculpted plastic figures don't, although I've seen some very good digital sculptors who are able to embrace that handmade look and have created some very good digital sculpts in the style of handmade sculptors, which is really refreshing to see. But so many people talk about miniatures having soul when that's clearly nonsense. They don't have soul. And when they talk about having character, do you mean that you're able to read expression and intent in that figure more than you are in something else? I'm not sure that's necessarily true, because you can get very good expressions on digital sculpts by the nature of being able to zoom in and sculpt stuff at whatever size and then shrink it again. So I don't think that's quite what they mean, but I do think that there's some science to it. So the older figures, the proportions aren't true by any stretch of the imagination. And that's intentional. That's not that the sculptors didn't know what proportion a human body was. But if you shrink that figure down to 28 millimeters or 25 millimeters and your head is true proportion, your eye can't see it from where you're stood on the tabletop, so you can't read that expression. No matter how good it is, unless you're looking through a lens up close at it, you can't read it. So it's fine for a display piece, but you're going to think that a model whose head you can see and whose expression you can read from a distance is going to have stand out as having more character just by the nature of you can see what their intent is. So the odd proportions, the big hands and the big heads of 80s, 90s miniatures is deliberate. It's not restriction on the sculpting size. It's not lack of knowledge of perception, of proportion on the part of the sculptor. It's an intentionality to make sure that you can see what's going on that figure from a distance. And I think that's a part of it, for sure.
Yeah, it's all just almost analogues, isn't it? It's all just, everything's building up the experience that we then have on the tabletop, everything from the way the miniatures are made to the way the terrain is. And then, of course, it's the collaboration between you as the sculptor and the person who's bought the miniature and painted it themselves. They'd bought into it then. And yeah, it gives you this whole holistic experience, I guess, doesn't it? So, but it's really interesting to kind of hear your thoughts on that character question. What's got your attention right now in the hobby? What are you painting, playing, or planning for this month? Head on over to bedroombattlefields.com/voicemail to submit a clip for our monthly hobby update episode. That link again is bedroombattlefields.com/voicemail. And now back to the show.
There's the, I mean, we talked a little bit earlier as well about the kind of mystery of the unknown things, that figure that you can't quite trace. And I think if you have figures that are drawing on very different source material that are very different from your generic fantasy orc, as has become accepted, or your generic fantasy elf that we now would see and we'd know immediately what that figure was. If you're looking at something that's slightly different, you've got that air of mystery again. You've got that sense of I'm not quite sure what this is. So my imagination can start filling in the background around here. That's why I'm. Although over the years the Woods world has fleshed out a bit, for sure, it's definitely grown. There's the background has definitely deepened, because the longer you sit with something, the more you work at it, the more feeds into it, the more realized it gets. But I don't ever want it to get to the point where I'm detailing every aspect of every element of this fantasy world, because I want there to be unknowns. I want there to be things that people are coming to and using their own imagination to fill in the gaps, because I think that's as much part of the hobby as the painting and the sculpting and the gaming is, that kind of world creation element. So it's one of the reasons that I picked the Vermeer as an early as a race to get back into, because they weren't fully developed. There was very little lore on them. So there's a lot of scope for you to take that army in a direction that you want to take it in. And you don't just have to read lots of army books and lore and work out what's actually going on with them. You can have fun and play around and make up your own stuff. And I really want that to be still a part of whatever, you know, if people are picking up Oakbound stuff to play the games, I want at least 50% of the invention of that world to be in their own heads. I don't want to spell it out, because you lose the opportunities to take stuff in directions that you want to take it in, because you feel like you've got to conform to official law. And nothing's official. You know, it's your fantasy world. You bought into it. You do what you want with it. By not fully realizing everything, it's kind of giving that permission for people to fill in the blanks in their own ways, and nothing is wrong. Do what you like with it.
So 10 years in, what's kind of front and center for you just now in terms of anything you've just released or anything you're looking ahead to putting out?
Well, just now, Shiver Shield is everything. Well, in fact, I mean, that's not strictly true, because it's been finished for about 6 weeks now. It went off to the printers, and that's it, line drawn under the making of it. But I'm still casting for Salute next weekend. I'm still packing boxes. It's a major relaunch of the range for me, so it's pretty all-consuming. I'm looking forward to freeing up some space in my studio, which is currently full of boxes and loose castings that need to be packed and that kind of thing. So once Salute is out of the way, I'm looking forward to giving myself some non-Oakbound hobby time as well. I've got a set of Heroes for Dungeon Quest that I am very keen to get painted up. They've been sat around for over a year now after I got really excited and managed to collect them all. I haven't got around to painting them, but I have just booked a table for Bring Out Your Lead to run Dungeon Quest on Sunday there. So that means that I now have to paint them. So looking forward to getting those painted. I've also got another few miniatures to add to my Space Hulk set that I'm kind of quite keen to get to as well. But at the moment, everything is buried under boxes. So Salute is my big focus. And the promotion of Shiver Shield, which is the latest iteration of the Woods skirmish game that myself and my former housemate from when I lived in Bristol, Mr. Roderick Hamilton, we've been working on that for the last 2 years, refining that, shaping that. Very, very pleased with it as a rule set. We got a really nice write-up in War Games Illustrated this month, which was lovely. Yeah, and it kind of feels like it's coming together. That the few things that have sat uneasily with me with that skirmish set for the last 5 or 6 years, we've now managed to iron out. So I'm very happy with it as a product. I think it hangs together really nicely, and we've managed to do it as a two-player starter set as well. So for the first time, because of the success of a couple of games that I released last year, there have been some funds in the bank to invest in getting cardstock printed. So we've got a nice set of tokens and counters and templates in the box. There's bespoke tape measures in the box. There's lots of dice. You get two warbands worth of metal figures, of course, metal figures. So yeah, it's a chunky old box, but a two-player starter set is the absolute dream for a small company to be able to produce. In previous years, we've managed to release books, because books are relatively easy, especially using print-on-demand sites. But being able to buy in bulk cardstock in the quantities that you have to buy it in order to get printing at a reasonable cost is a real game changer. So yeah, I think it's going to look very pretty. It's a really nice looking box. I'm very happy with the gameplay. I'm very happy with the way that we've restructured 10 years worth of miniatures development, miniature range development, so that it's all very cohesive now, and the factions play together. Each one plays very uniquely, very individually, but they work together as a whole really nicely. They all fill different niches. Yeah, I'm really, really satisfied with how that's come out. And we do have some follow-ups planned. We've got a supplement planned that maybe will come out in the autumn. But I think once this launch is done, I need to step away from it for a little bit, get my head clear, do a few other projects, and then I'll come back to it with some refreshed enthusiasm. We've got a date for our annual open air games day. We do a day in the woods in Gloucestershire every summer. So that's going to be 4th of July this year. It's just a free day, rock up, bring your stuff, play some games, go home again. But that's always really nice. So we've got that booked in now for the summer.
Where is the best place for the listener to keep up with everything then? Just the website itself?
Yeah, I'd go to oakbound.co.uk. At the moment, I'm rebuilding the website, so that not everything is up there. The shop is currently dormant. But if you go to the news part of that website, you can sign up for the Acorn, which is our monthly e-zine. I mean, it's essentially a mailing list, but I try and not be all spammy with the mailing list. I try and have some decent hobby content in there. So this month, the main content has been a look at other things that are happening at Salute. So I've done a little guide of people who are releasing things that I think people who are interested in Oakbound stuff might also be interested in checking out at the show, and some online links that if you're not going to the show, you can check out their stuff digitally, remotely. Last month, we covered a couple of the war bands that have were around for second edition Woods Skirmish through the supplements, but aren't in the core book for the new release. So we covered rules, get you by rules to field those warbands in the new set. We're going to have some scenarios for Deepwood Shadows, which is our role play set in the same world, our role play game. Those will be coming out quite shortly. So that's the best place to find out what's fresh and new. On the website, you'll also find links. We've got a Discord if you just want to chat about stuff. We've got a Facebook group. We've got an Instagram. We've got a Blue Sky. And we've got a YouTube channel, which is partly talking about Oakbound stuff. We're doing a series at the moment where we're digging into each faction one by one and talking about the influences on them, the way that they play, some tactics for playing them, what you can take in your warband, some models that you might want to choose. But I also do a Decades of Dwarf series, so looking through old copies of White Dwarf and comparing them 10 years apart or 5 years apart to see the kind of aesthetic differences and the style of the magazine, how it's changed through the years. And we quite often find that 10 years apart or 5 years apart, you'll find the same subject cropping up but looked at in quite a different way. So the contrast is often quite interesting, seeing how the trends of the time and the intentions of the company have shifted slightly alongside the technology that's available to them, and the way that the artwork style has changed to reflect other kind of cultural references on people at the time, who the target audience is. It's an interesting comparison, I think.
Thanks very much for listening to this episode of the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. If you enjoy the show, then please do share it with someone else you think might enjoy it too. And be sure to check out our Discord community of like-minded hobbyists, which you could find at bedroombattlefields.com/Discord. It'd be great to see you in there.